Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora and welcome to After the Virus, a series of RENZ panel discussions hosted by me, Guyan Espiner. We're talking with New Zealand and international experts looking at how our world will change in the wake of COVID-19. We're going to speak about how we live, how we govern ourselves, the future of our economies, the healthcare systems of the world, and our environment. In this episode, we're focusing on the economy. How will the pandemic affect the wealth of nations, our ability to look after the old, and the futures that we leave for our young people? I'm joined by Philippe Legrain. He's an independent thinker, a communicator, a political entrepreneur. He describes himself as a passionate believer in openness. He's the author of four critically acclaimed books, including Open World, The Truth About Globalization, and Aftershock, Reshaping the World Economy After the Crisis. That crisis was the GFC, not the current one. Sir John Key is also with us. He was the Prime Minister of New Zealand, of course, between 2008 and 2016, and was also Tourism Minister for that time. He's returned to the commercial world post-politics, including directorships in two of the sectors we will talk about today, banking and tourism. Our third guest is Simon Mair. Now, Simon is an ecological economist whose research interests include the history of economic thought and utopian economics. He teaches at Salford University and holds a PhD in ecological economics, an MA in environmental management, and a BSc in environmental science. Let's start, though, by getting a fix on the magnitude of the problem we are facing, of the challenge we are dealing with. And let's go to you firstly, Sir John Key. What is the size of this? How deep, how bad, how long?
I think you can run out of adjectives to describe it, really, Guyan. I mean, you know, the reality is we're dealing with two crises running concurrently, essentially, a health crisis and obviously an economic crisis. And while one's creating the other, both of them are, you know, extreme in their making. I think the second thing is you've got a global aspect to this, and more pronounced than we've seen, probably even with something like the GFC, which obviously washed around the world. But, you know, for instance, when that happened, China was in much stronger shape, for instance. It really was a part of the equation that actually helped the world out of the GFC, and certainly from New Zealand's point of view, as it became a more significant trading partner, was a real support mechanism. So I think, you know, that gives you a sense of the real scale. I mean, I think ultimately the good news, if there is some, is that the banks at the moment are typically, you know, the problem child when it actually comes to recessions and economic crises. This case, actually, they're not starting out, at least in that position, from what we can see in our part of the world. Balance sheets are strong, liquidity is good. And in fact, in our case, you know, our customers are, for the most part, so far doing pretty well. But obviously, there are big clouds, you know, on the horizon, and there are issues. But I mean, I think to me, in my mind, the big challenge ultimately will be how quickly can we get to a position where we can return to some normality? Will that take a vaccine, and can the world actually even deliver one? And then the second bit, I think, will be just what is the shakeout from the economic perspective? How long can some companies hold on, and ultimately, when does confidence return to the consumer?
And Philippe, you studied the GFC pretty carefully. How does it compare with that in your view?
Oh, well, this is John said, it is an order of magnitude bigger. In fact, it in some respects compares to the 1930s. Certainly, in the speed of the collapse, and unprecedented in the fact that, you know, half the global economy has basically been shut down by government fiat. But I think there's still a lot of optimism around, certainly in financial markets, that this is going to be what's called a V-shaped recovery, that even though the collapse has been severe, that the bounce back is going to be equally strong. And I think that that is completely delusional. It's completely delusional because for the foreseeable future, we're going to have crippling uncertainty, not just about how the virus is going to pan out, but also in terms of how economies are going to be able to cope and policymakers respond. That, you know, the idea that you can simply shut down an economy, even an advanced economy, with the exceptional government support measures that's being provided, and suddenly just flick a switch and it gets going again, I think is not true. I think the idea that it's going to be, you know, a V-shaped recovery is nonsense. And I think obviously financial markets, partly with help from central banks, have got ahead of themselves massively. I think if you ask the ordinary person in the street, how do they see the future? It's never been more uncertain. And in that kind of scenario, I think that this is going to be a lasting crisis, potentially like the GFC, which has aftershocks which last for a whole decade.
Simon, a V-shaped recovery, delusional, nonsensical. do you share those sentiments?
Yes, basically. I don't think we're going to see anything like a V-shaped recovery. I think this idea of returning to normality kind of underplays the role that our kind of economic systems played in us not being able to respond well, not being able to respond rapidly to this kind of crisis. And given that we know with things like climate change, other crises are coming, I think a return to normality is a mistake. What we need is a real transformation to a more kind of resilient economy.
Okay, I'll return to some of those themes because they are really interesting. I've read some of your thinking on this, and you believe it is an opportunity to create a new kind of economy. So we will get to that. I'm just intrigued, though, and I'll come back to you, John Key. Why is the share market? The S&P 500 had its best month since January 1987. I mean, what do they know that we don't?
I think the cynical answer would be, I don't know, but I wish they'd tell us so we can work it out. Look, I think ultimately, if you think about the share market, I think my own view is that they're responding in part to the fact that they see a very long period of extremely low interest rates. And so if you believe that that's the picture, then ultimately, for those that have investable income, and you've got some, you know, notwithstanding drawdowns and the likes, you know, just gigantic funds around the world, whether they're real money funds or hedge funds or, you know, private equity, whatever it might be, it needs to find a home to use that capital. And if the interest rate bond markets are very, very low, then maybe they're arguing there'll be better returns somewhere else. I think it also varies a little bit. When you look at the S&P, obviously, or the Dow Jones, it measures the average across the index. But if you look and drill down within some of those stocks, what you are seeing is some, you know, pretty significant declines in certain stocks, but others obviously doing, you know, a lot better. And so it's not surprising that a company like Zoom, for instance, would be doing extremely well because we're all on it at the moment. It's not surprising that Amazon's coming through this well because, you know, again, we're all shopping online. But then there are other companies which clearly, you know, for instance, I'm guessing if you were Airbnb, you know, pre-IPO, but if you're Airbnb looking like it was going to go to the market pretty soon, looks to me to be a lot more challenging given, you know, no one's traveling very much. So it does vary within the sector. But I mean, to the point that Philippe was making, you know, you have to have really heroic assumptions, in my view, to believe it's a V-shaped recovery. And that's simply because of the destruction that's happening to, you know, the economy globally, you know, the utter destructions in some sectors, you know, massive sort of wipeout. So in my mind, at least, it is an interest rate story. I'd want to be pretty cautious, is my own view.
Well, let's talk about that then, move to government response. I mean, if you look at a crisis like 9/11, George W. Bush famously said, go shopping. But, you know, we can't shop our way out of this one, can we, Simon? We can't. That's the difficulty with the stimulus, because it isn't really the answer this time, is it?
Yeah, no, but the bottom line is that you, at least until you have a vaccine, you have to stop people from mixing, right? And so you have, basically, people have to stay at home. And so that means that the entire idea of a stimulus is to get people out there, get people mixing, get people back in workplaces, get them in shopping centers again. And so it just goes against everything you, like all the medical advice, all the kind of epidemiological advice. And so, I mean, I think John's right. I think what we're seeing is that what happens is when you stop all of that, when you kind of shut that kind of market economy activity down, it has has devastating effects. And so again, for me, the kind of a big lesson from this crisis is how do we design an economy which doesn't destroy people's lives when it has to be paused for a while?
Is that possible? I mean, what would an economy like that look like? You're talking about a scaling back of production somehow as an answer, are you?
Yes, basically. We know that production, not all production has stopped now, right? So we've protected certain kind of key industries. And really, I think that's part of what that's highlighting is how much of our economy does stuff which we don't really need. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that this, you know, kind of everything about a lockdown or anything really about a lockdown is a good thing. But I do think that COVID is really highlighting is which bits of the economy are really essential to our lives and which bits are kind of important because of the way we built the economy, but which we could do without and do differently.
Philippe, are you seeing in terms of governments that are getting a response right? What should we be doing in terms of a government response to this economically?
Yeah, I'd like to take an issue with two things that Simon said. First of all, I don't think that governments are actually providing stimulus. They're providing support, which is different. Central banks are providing liquidity on the basis that that is the issue at hand. And that's part of the problem that companies face. But I think the other problem that they're going to face is solvency problems. And that's something that central banks can't cope with, i.e. it's not just they face cash flow problems, it's that many of them are going to go bust. What are governments doing? Governments aren't stimulating either. They've shut down large parts of the economy. What they're doing is they're providing insurance. They're trying to support the incomes of workers, and they're trying to support the cash flows of businesses so that they can survive this shutdown. The stimulus will come once the lockdowns are lifted, and that's when it will be necessary. And then we'll see how effective those measures are, given that some of the shutdown of the economy is not due to government action, but due to the fact that people are simply scared to go out and spend and move around. I'd also take issue with somehow the idea that this crisis highlights a choice between the sort of valuable parts of the economy and those that aren't. I think that's kind of a false choice. I mean, basically, governments around the world have been forced into lockdowns because of a lack of preparedness for a pandemic, despite the warnings from Bill Gates and others that this was likely, despite the dry run we had with SARS in Asia. And you've seen actually that many Asian governments have done much better. They've been much more effective, perhaps not than New Zealand, but much more effective than many European and certainly the United States in limiting the number of deaths through mass testing and tracing without actually imposing lockdowns and therefore without the punitive economic cost. And therefore, we've been forced into this trade-off, but actually with better preparation, we wouldn't need to make that trade-off. And in future, hopefully, governments will be better prepared, and so we don't need to make it. To go one step further, I would say, simply to say that the parts of the economy that have been kept going are the ones that are essential and the ones that have been shut down aren't important. Well, that's not the case. The parts of the economy that have been shut down, and most people would say that travel or socializing with friends are important. We're just simply doing without them temporarily for the sake of a public health emergency. Once we emerge from that emergency, once we have a vaccine, those are things which are desirable and which you want to get going again. In fact, some would say actually they're part of the joy of life and therefore incredibly important.
Simon, do you want to respond to that?
I mean, I would not put those within, I mean, socializing with friends is not something which comes under kind of a market economy lockdown, right? And actually a lot of what we've seen in the UK is that actually kind of non-foundational parts of the economy have been encouraged to keep going, to keep the market economy going. We've got non-essential construction, lots of non-essential work still happening.
So John, if I could come to you, if we are going to get into situations where governments take on a lot more debt, and that is going to be pretty clear. Are we then going to go into the austerity cycle? Now, I know you were Prime Minister in the GFC. You guys were careful about the response afterwards, but you had a lot of what we called zero budgets, where you didn't spend new money for quite a number of years. And it was important for you and the finance minister at the time to get back in the black, and you did that eventually. Is there a risk here that we're going to rack up a lot of debt and then go through this austerity cycle to try to pay it back? Does the response need to be different this time?
I think it really depends on which country you are. I mean, if you look at the United States and you look at its national debt levels at, you know, north of $20 trillion now, and, you know, the response of the Trump administration, which is, you know, huge amounts of cash being pumped into the system. You know, I worry both about the nominal amount of debt they actually now have, but I actually worry even prior to COVID-19, not about even the quantum of debt, but the fact that there's probably no figures I've seen coming out of their budgetary office that indicate they'll ever be back in surplus. I mean, it's really a living beyond your means system that they've had operated quite a long period of time. But the truth of the matter is that if you're the United States and arguably even the United Kingdom and other countries, their capacity to always fund themselves and to do so, you know, at low and at rates relative to the rest of the world and relative to LIBOR is real. But if you take a country like New Zealand, I've always been a bit of the view, right or wrong, that we're a little country, we're at the bottom of the world, no one owes us a living. We always have had a risk premium on our bond issues, even, you know, even in the great times. And so if we amass too much national debt, then I really worry about that, not just because future generations ultimately got to pay for it, but we're just in a fundamentally riskier position, for instance. And I think, you know, when it comes to the response, I mean, you know, you can argue about each individual component piece, whatever you think about those things. I thought there were some things, for instance, you know, the Rudd administration after the GFC decided to give every Australian, I think, $900. You know, New Zealand Tourism had a great run out of that because we marketed a package at $899 Aussie for people to come over. And I think Tabcorp had a pretty good run in Australia out of it. But was it the best use of money? In my personal opinion, no. But for instance, is the wage subsidy that the government's got operating in New Zealand, and I'm sure there are variations there around the world, is that sensible in my view? Absolutely. I mean, you know, you're to Philippe's point, you're trying to hold people in the game for a period of time. So I think it depends. But I'm just naturally cautious, and I kind of think, you know, ultimately, if you come from that school of at some point when you borrow money, you've got to repay it, then I do think that puts a burden on future generations of whatever country you come from to pay that. And also, it's about choices. And I mean, you know, we've raised the issue of, okay, why aren't governments better prepared for, say, for instance, a pandemic? Here's the answer. It costs a hell of a lot of money for that preparedness to be in perfect shape, ready to go. Now, people might want to disagree with me, but the truth of the matter are politicians live in short-term cycles, 3, 4, 5-year election cycles. There's always a constituency for every dollar of expenditure, and some of them earn votes more than others. And I suspect if you say to people, I'm spending money building you a new road or giving you a tax cut or going out and spending a bit more on grandma's health, that just works a whole lot better than saying I'm stacking up a whole lot more PPE gear that we might need one day when a pandemic comes. That's the harsh reality of modern day politics.
It's hard, isn't it, Philip, to prepare for something like this? Or do you think that we realistically should have been better organised to deal with something of this magnitude?
Well, I think it's certainly something that experts have been warning about. That it was a very real risk, and actually the cost ahead of time investing in preventive measures isn't huge. In terms of the debt, I think that, you know, I think it would be a big mistake if governments were to engage in the kind of austerity they engaged with after the GFC, because the burden fell often on the poorest and the most vulnerable. And the result of that has been a polarization of politics and the rise of nationalism and populism, and ultimately threatened so many good things. I think that in the short term, There is ample opportunity for governments to be able to borrow and spend. And there's ample opportunity for central banks to help them in so doing, at least in advanced economies, by buying those bonds, whether it's through QE or other measures, for the simple reason that we live in a world not of inflation, but of deflation. And in a world of deflation, there isn't enough demand in the economy, and therefore central banks and governments can cooperate. The big issue comes is that when at some point in the future we come back into what used to be seen like a more normal economy, where the central bank's role is to try and keep tabs on excessive spending on the economy to prevent inflation coming out, when we reach that point, how are we going to react? Now, is the reaction going to be mass debt write-downs? Is it going to be further monetization, in which case the likelihood is that we get out of this through inflation at some point down the line, would, you know, in effect write down those debts? I think we're a long way away from that now. For the immediate term, the problem is going to be a deflation, not enough spending in the economy, and it's important that both governments and central banks do their best to prop up the economy and indeed to ensure a stronger recovery.
Okay, you're talking about a return to a normal economy, and I think Simon doesn't want to return to a normal economy, and so we'll come to that in just a second. But I just want to explore this idea of monetary financing. So, and I'll probably expose my own ignorance here, but effectively this would be a central bank just creating money and giving it to a government. What's wrong with that? I mean, John Key, you've been both a prime minister, helped run an economy, and also had major roles in banks. You'd be pretty well placed to tell us. Why can't a central bank just give a government tens of billions of dollars?
Well, I think they are running around thinking about spending $50 billion, from what I hear from some of the cabinet papers. So I don't think you're too far off your own.
But seriously, I mean, the problem there is inflation, right? But it's nowhere to be seen. So
no, I think inflation, you're right. Look, historically, you'd say, okay, if you print money, you get money in the system, however you, whatever mechanism you do like that, and you flood the place with cash. You know, one issue has historically been inflation. I happen to agree with Philippe, you know, the odds of inflation coming back anytime soon, given what's happened with oil prices and actually what's happening with new energy technologies and all those sorts of things, you know. I mean, yeah, I think that risk is pretty low. But there's another risk, actually, and I think that sort of links a bit in why, I mean, I certainly absolutely support governments and our government spending plenty of money supporting people. And it sort of comes back to that argument, isn't it, that, you know, monetary policy needs mates, because the problem that you have when you just flood them with cash is you're assuming they're going to make the right decisions when you give them the money. And I think the worry is that you have a lot of cash, you don't have good feedback loops, you get a lot of the money going into the system, and the question is, does it get spent in the right place? I just look at it and say, okay, sure, if you can tell me the building infrastructure we need, that they're doing all the things we need, good on you, but I worry about it. And to go back to the monetary policy needs mates, it's really simple just to say it's all about money. But is it solely about that? I mean, you know, the government's made some tentative moves in New Zealand to say, well, let's improve, we'll make the RMA a little bit easier, the Resource Management Act. Well, actually, if that makes it easier for some companies to do some things, as long as it's not stupid stuff, I reckon that's a good thing. I think we can just, we're in a world, and it's been around since the GFC and you know, quantitative easing, that if the answer to absolutely everything is flood the place with cash. And I'm just, yeah, I get it. It's absolutely a need for that liquidity, but it's not the only answer to every problem we face.
Simon, let's bring you back in here. You, from the reading I've done of your thinking on this, think it's an opportunity to do something different from the sort of consensus around free market economies that we've had for the last 30 years or so. What is it that you would like to see this crisis used as an opportunity to do, to reshape our economy?
I suppose I just kind of want to pick up on this idea of it's an opportunity, right? Like it's, I'm not sure I would use the word opportunity. Like I would say it's a moment of change. And I think that change is coming one way or the other, as in, there are kind of very powerful actors who have like very big interests in the way the economy is run now, in kind of attempting to strengthen their own position in markets, and they will attempt to push that. And we see that happening now, and they will push their own changes through. what I'm kind of advocating for is that this also opens up kind of a moment of change for something, I would say, kind of more humane and just a better way of doing things, right? Which is that we know there are all kinds of crises, social and ecological, coming and unfolding around us right now. So this is all kinds of things around everything from, like, let's say, participation of disabled people in all aspects of society to the unfolding climate crisis. The things that I would personally like to see are around things taking basic essentials out of the market, essentially. So taking things like food and shelter out of the market. One thing that will do is that if you have another crisis like this in the future, where your market economy effectively has to shut down, is it won't be as devastating to people. Because it will mean that if you lose your job, you're not at risk of losing your home. You could do this through a kind of, you can do any of these things through a very kind of state-centered model. So something like a national food service, let's say, or you could do it through a more kind of community provisioning model, where you kind of, you create the material support to enable communities to do kind of more kind of co-ops, more mutual aid groups, that kind of thing.
You're listening to After the Virus, a series of RNZ panel discussions hosted by me, Guyan Espiner, about how our lives will change in the wake of COVID-19.
I'd hate to look like we're beating up on Simon, but can I offer a slightly counter view? And that is that, and, you know, I might be at cross purposes here, but you go back to the New Zealand economy, you know, back in the Muldoon days, it was a very closed, you know, it was Fortress New Zealand, very closed economy. There wasn't really a market-based economy. And actually, as we've become exposed to a real market-based economy globally, we've become far better at producing a product that people actually want in quantities that they want. And actually, even things like climate change have been addressed and increasingly being addressed through that. As consumers themselves have said, you know, very strongly, we want a more organic product, and we want you to care for your environment, and we want you to demonstrate all those things. I mean, I think the market actually drives, in the end, often the right behaviour. I know a lot of people wouldn't agree with that, but I actually think it drives, you know, structural and behavioural change. And without that, you know, you go back and have a look at those, you know, Soviet Union countries and have a look at what they did prior to, you know, opening up their borders and have a look what they do today. I think it's better today.
But our response in a crisis like this, I mean, is, and as the old joke goes, you know, everyone is a socialist in a crisis. If you look at the UK, Spain, Denmark's response, I mean, it's something approaching state capitalism as an approach. In New Zealand, about north of 40% of people are on a government subsidy.
Yeah, well, look at the risk of dominating the conversation. I mean, you know, as you say, everyone's a socialist in a crisis. But my only basic point would be there are times when the private sector can't respond. These are one of them, because fundamentally the marketplace economy is shut down because of a health crisis. So actually it's a little bit like saying, should a government ever run a deficit? Of course it should, because you're the balancing part of the equation, and in bad times in the economy, the automatic stabilizers cut in, and of course you're going to have to pay out. But my simple point is, overall, if you really look at overall, I think the world has driven enormous change through the market. And if you go and have a look at, I don't know, any of these tech companies, actually, there's been huge amounts of capital because of the market coming to those tech companies, many of them climate change focused. Look at the increasing both global demand and capital being applied to plant-based meat, for instance, whether it's Beyond Meats or Impossible Foods or whatever. All these kind of guys are responding to what's happening in the marketplace. Capital's there because of that. Consumers are aware because of that. I don't know. To me, I think this is just an extreme point in time. But if you're asking what it should be like under normal circumstances, I think too much government leads to the wrong outcomes and bad allocation of resources. But, you know,
Philippe?
Well, it's certainly true that governments have rightly taken on a much bigger role in a medical and an economic emergency. What they haven't been doing, though, is setting up national food services. It's still food grown by private farmers sold by private supermarkets. And after the initial panic buying, that system works well. It doesn't seem to me that the role for government is in providing a national food service. It is acting as an insurer of last resort in a crisis like this. It is also there to provide the necessary stimulus when it's right to do so. While I think, therefore, to kind of junk the market system would be a mistake, I think it is clear that there are all sorts of reforms which could be made to make the system fairer and to make the system more resilient, that give you the benefits of market dynamism at the same time as, you know, greater stability and greater social justice. So it's quite obvious, for example, that, you know, we all think it's, well, many of us think it's fantastic that you can have food from delivered cheaply to your home by food delivery services. At the same time, the people who deliver those services are often self-employed with no protection whatsoever on meager wages. And you've seen that actually there's going to be a big debate about whether those people ought to be better protected and better paid than they have been previously. Or, for example, that we thought that the key workers in an economy potentially were bankers. And actually, while there's an important role for finance, there's also an important role for the people who are keeping us safe, who are, you know, working in hospitals, not just as doctors, but also as porters and cleaners and so on. And that there would be a social reevaluation of what really matters. So it's not a question of junking the market economy, but it's a question of putting in reforms to ensure that the proceeds of growth are better shared, and that our sense of value as a society, what we care about, is better reflected. Because very often what happens is that the cost of change and the cost of disruption fall on those people who are least able to bear it. That's not just economically damaging. In a crisis like this, I think it's also seen as morally wrong. So I think there is an impetus for reform there.
Simon, do you think that that re-evaluation will happen? I mean, many of us have talked about this, haven't we? The guy on minimum wage at your supermarket is suddenly an essential worker to your life and who's actually really putting their lives on the line. Meanwhile, some CEOs are sitting at home wondering, people are wondering what they did in the first place. Do you think we are going to have that re-evaluation ourselves, or do you reckon we're going to just return back to normal?
I think it depends. So I don't see how, without really questioning, really changing that role for markets in our society, you get people who are currently on low pay to be paid more. It's a fundamental conflict, I think. I also just really want to push back on what Sir John was saying about this idea that kind of private capital and markets are really delivering for us on climate change, because they're not. I mean, yes, we see kind of some small movement towards a bit more renewables, a bit more plant-based meat. We also see massive, massive growth in global carbon emissions. And that growth in global carbon emissions correlates incredibly well to the Industrial Revolution, to the birth of capitalism, and to the rise of massive market economies. To say, oh, well, in the last kind of decade, we've had a bit more kind of interest in plant-based meat, therefore climate change is going to be solved by the markets, just seems incredible to me.
Well, I don't think it will be entitled, but I do think pretty strongly, actually, that we will see technological change and through technology and better science, some of those issues around climate change will resolve. I'm not saying all of them, but if you think about, you know, something like meat and food, it's, you know, particularly the meat sector, it's 18% of world emissions. And arguably, if the world went to only eating plant-based meat, actually, you'd be a long way towards solving climate change. I mean, again, if you think about, you know, the advent of electric cars and electric transportation, I mean, again, you know, science is playing an amazing role there, and so is Tesla, yeah, the stock of its production. I mean, same story. I mean, you're starting to see a lot of change. So, yeah, I accept the argument that there's going to be a home for capital where it makes a return, and I accept that, you know, there's a long way to go. I'm not saying all these issues are solved. I'm just simply saying to you that, you know, there is, you know, it depends on the structure of your system. But again, if you take a country like New Zealand, we introduced an emissions trading scheme, we started pricing carbon, and actually that did see capital dramatically change where it was allocated. With the entire time I was Prime Minister, there was never a fossil fuel power plant established in New Zealand. All the money went to wind farms or geothermal power stations. So you can change where capital is allocated.
Let's move to globalisation, which has been another big force over the last few decades. Do you see this as a blow for globalisation, Philippe, this pandemic?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, remember this pandemic started in China and led to the disruption of all sorts of supply chains of Western companies that basically produce in China. And what that highlighted was the fragility of much of the production that we rely on. And I think that as a result of that, you know, companies are increasingly going to look to provide more resilient production. What does that mean? Well, in part, it means they're going to diversify away from China and produce, say, in Vietnam or Indonesia. I think perhaps not in the case of New Zealand, but certainly in the case of the US and Europe, they're going to produce closer to home. So, you know, European companies in Eastern Europe or North Africa, American ones in Mexico. And that at the same time, using new technologies like robots or 3D printing, that some production is going to happen back home. So I think that's one blow to globalization. I think perhaps the bigger blow to globalization is that, you know, in theory, this crisis ought to be requires international cooperation. The virus cuts across borders. It doesn't respect them. It affects everybody. At the same time, what we've seen throughout this crisis is mostly been every government for itself. And we've seen, you know, while this could have been an opportunity for the US and China to collaborate, instead President Trump calling it a Chinese virus and the Chinese spreading all sorts of disinformation back, and therefore the geopolitical tensions that existed between those two countries being even greater, the threat to trade that poses being magnified, the arbiter of global trade, the World Trade Organization, increasingly sidelined. And then we've seen how many countries have brought in, you know, curbs on exports, or whether it is medicines or food. And therefore, actually, you know, I don't agree with President Trump at all, but actually his argument somehow meant much production ought to be localized for national security grounds, suddenly is going to have a much wider currency, because people are going to say, and are saying, well, actually, this is an essential, we can't rely on foreigners for our food, we can't rely on foreigners for our medicines, we can't rely on our food, foreigners for, and the list is going to get longer and longer and longer. And therefore, that is open season for everyone who wants to relocalize production. Now, personally, I think that that would be a mistake, but I think that's certainly the way that the wind is blowing.
Simon, do you see the wind blowing that way? And is it a wind that that doesn't do anyone any good?
I think it's really very hard to tell. And this is partly why I say when this is kind of a moment for change, because Philippe is right, like there are going to be these kind of pressures, and we're going to see even particularly political pressures around kind of relocalizing production, and you'll get kind of these kind of nationalist populists using this, I think, as a vehicle to move. But I also think they're going to be up against some serious opposition. What will be interesting to see is which is the stronger pull. Is it the pull from the kind of the big globalized corporations, or these kind of more local interests around localization?
John Key, these sorts of movements could be quite harmful, couldn't they, for a small trading nation like New Zealand?
Yeah, although funny enough, actually, they might, in a weird kind of way, be advantageous, actually, versus as it might sound. Because I think actually if you take a step back for a second, say pre-COVID-19, what were we seeing? Well, we were already seeing this trend towards nationalisation, populism, and certainly a breakdown, I think, in the relationship between China and the United States. And I think the simple reason for that has been that it's actually the political viewpoint in the United States, actually across both Republican voters and Democratic voters, is whether it's right or wrong, is that China doesn't play fair, it steals our intellectual property, and we've effectively gone backwards from engaging in a fight where we've got one arm tied behind our back. And that's why I think Donald Trump's taken the position he's taken in terms of trade with the US, with China, because what he says is, I think in his own mind, if I stand up to the Chinese and I ultimately get a better deal as a result of it, then good on me. I've proven that I've got the art of the deal and I'm a good deal maker. And by the way, if I don't get a deal, my supporters will like that, and my popularity in terms of the way I handle this issue, trade, will improve actually, because I'm seen to standing up to the guys that aren't playing fair. And that is absolutely true, I think, in terms of what you see in the US. This has just taken that to a whole new level. So the relationship's clearly getting worse and deteriorating by the day. The only reason why I say it could vaguely be better for New Zealand is that if you think about our major trading partners, we're no longer Britain's little farm. They're an important trading partner for us, but quite a long way down the order. Number one, of course, remains Australia, although pretty close, and goods and services, arguably China's bigger now. And so if China isn't buying from the United States, then maybe they're going to favour their purchases to New Zealand. Now, that depends a whole lot on many, many different circumstances and outcomes. It depends how the government handles it. But, there's always going to be, with that growing middle class in China, huge demand for what we produce. So, ironically, we might actually have better trade links into China as a result. It's not worse. But globally, no question, I think free trade is really out of favour and going backwards.
Philippe, would you agree with that? You've spent a good deal of your career promoting the advantages of free trade. Do you see a return to economic nationalism and even a ditching of this idea of comparative advantage from people just manufacturing things themselves? We've had the Deputy Prime Minister of our own country in New Zealand saying we should manufacture things here even if they cost 15% more. And, there's an audience for that sort of, for those sorts of thoughts.
Sure. I mean, I also worked for your late Prime Minister, Mike Ball, when he was Director General of the World Trade Organization. And he would be very saddened to see what is happening to globalization. I mean, I think that, Sir John is right, potentially that New Zealand could be, could benefit from a diversion of trade from the US to New Zealand. I think that though there is a bigger risk, which is potentially that relations between the US and China get so bad that in effect countries are forced to choose. And if that were to be the case, then that would be an invidious position for a country like New Zealand, given that, culturally and as a democracy, it is clearly in a so-called Western ambit. At the same time, increasingly economically, it is reliant on China. And if you come into a kind of new Cold War situation where countries are forced to choose, you could easily envisage such a world developing, and then it would be a very difficult situation indeed for New Zealand. I think more broadly, clearly, there are the arguments that drove globalization before still apply, producing internationally and benefiting from greater diversity and lower costs of trade means that there are strong reasons why companies are going to want to source internationally. At the same time, I think now the political momentum, which has been building since the GFC, even more so with the election of President Trump, and now exacerbated by the COVID-19 crisis, is the momentum is towards a fragmentation. That doesn't mean we go back to the kind of 1930s with like massively high tariff wars everywhere, but it does mean that you're going to have many more obstructions to trade than there were before. And it's not just in physical trade, it's also in digital trade. For example, more and more trade is digital. In the first wave of digitalization, that has created the possibility for much more internationalization. You can, if you're producing services and you're doing it electronically, you can sell internationally very easily. Increasingly, though, you're saying governments, actually, well, the world is the economy is increasingly digital, and we want to control it. And so we want to ensure that, you know, have data localization requirements. We want to have regulations of data privacy, and all of that tends to relocalize even what, you know, ought to be the most globalized part of the economy of all, which is the digital. So I think that actually, unfortunately, the momentum is in the wrong direction. That doesn't mean there isn't a battle to be had. There's a political battle to be had in favor of greater openness, but I don't think that it's going to be a very difficult one, is what I think.
Where do you sit on that battle, Simon? What side of the barricades are you on?
What kind of really strikes me is that I really do not know where our economies are heading, because I do think that what a big thing that we've seen with responses to COVID-19 is that things that have seemed impossible for 20, 30, 40 years are all of a sudden back on the table. And the exciting thing about that, I think, is that there are potentially new economic forms that we've not seen before that could come.
Let's, in this last segment of this discussion, look to the future and see what thoughts we've got about how it might change the way we run our economies. I mean, John Key, do you see us having a fundamental rethink about these structures, or do you think that it's just going to be a desperate scramble to return to what we had before?
I don't think we'll return in totality. In a lot of practical senses, actually, one of the things we've learned is, you know, actually we can work pretty effectively and efficiently from remote locations and save commutes and air pollution and a whole bunch of other things. So actually, I don't think the world's going to never go back to an office building and all those kinds of things. But I do think that you will see this has been quite a leap forward in terms of digital capability and people understanding what they can actually do, via a Zoom conference call or whatever. So I think you're going to see some changes there. I think, and look, I might be wrong, I'm viewing it a bit from a New Zealand lens and kind of trying to take a glass half full perspective on it. And that is, I can't help but wonder whether the people won't just sit back a little bit and say, wow, if a global pandemic can close the world economy and claim, you know, far too many lives and all of these things, they might just slightly reassess what they think is important. And, you know, whether New Zealand doesn't benefit a bit from that because we're a place with low number of cases and we look maybe just sort of says to people, well, I really got to come and travel to a place like New Zealand or maybe come and live here or, I don't know, enjoy what we produce. I mean, I think there are those sort of changes. But, you know, they always say markets are driven by fear and greed. You know, there's been a fair bit of fear in recent times. But I don't know, that fundamental premise of making money and, you know, I think that'll return as rapidly. So, it's a huge change at the moment. Will it be so huge at the end of it? I don't think so, but there'll definitely be some changes along the way for sure.
Philippe?
Well, I think governments have rightly asked people to make a huge collective sacrifice for the greater good. And I think that there will be expectations that those people who have made a big sacrifice at least see a fairer society coming out of that. Whether that actually happens in practice, I think is going to be a key theme of the politics in the years ahead. I think Sir John is right that obviously technology has moved forward in leaps and bounds in the space of a few weeks, and that, you know, if there is an economic upside from it, is that some of the productivity gains that from the better use of technology might be realized or continue to be realized in the post-crisis world, and that in turn could make people better off. One kind of reversal of trend one could see is that, you know, for decades and decades, increasingly connectivity and people have located in cities, and proximity to other people has been seen as desirable. People are willing to pay more in order to live in smaller flats in close proximity to others. It's an open question whether in a post-pandemic world where technology allows more remote working, whether people will think actually it's safer and more convenient to live at greater distance from each other. I think if they chose to do so, I think there would be an economic cost, because I think a lot of good ideas and new technologies come from people interacting with each other And while something like Zoom is fantastic, it's not the same as crossing paths with people and those serendipitous thoughts emerge.
That's right, isn't it? I think, is it Richard Harrison, the creative class idea that you create clusters back when clusters meant something positive? And the idea that even if you are a tech company, you still want to do your deals in cafes in San Francisco rather than actually doing them over Zoom, no disrespect to this current call.
Sure, that's absolutely true. And you know, Zoom is fantastic, and nobody's disputing that we're better off in this pandemic having than before. And it's, you know, I think many people will conclude that they don't need to make quite as many international business trips, that it will suffice for many run-of-the-mill meetings. At the same time, face-to-face interaction is much richer permits greater creativity than merely online kinds. And one has to hope that once people are able and feel safe to interact with each other again, they will continue to do so, not just socially, but also productively.
Simon, if I could finish with you, what are your hopes for how things will change for the good from this, some good that we'll take out of it?
What I'd like to see is people organising around that, is kind of taking an active role in their kind of in their politics and stepping in and saying, this is what I value, how do I make this happen? And that's where I think we'll start to see real transformative change.
All right, thank you very much, Simon. Simon Meyer, Philippe Legrain, and John Key. Thank you all for your thoughts and for your time and for your assessment of how we are going to get through this and what change it will have for our economies around the world. So thanks very much for your thoughts and for your time. After the Virus is produced by RNZ, by me, Guyan Espiner, and Justin Gregory. Claire Eastham-Farrelly is the visual director, Veronica Schmidt and Tim Watkin are the executive producers. You can also watch this series on video, so head over to rnz.co.nz/podcasts to catch that and for plenty of other great content. All RNZ podcasts are free to listen to and ad-free as well on rnz.co.nz and on the RNZ app.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.